like to talk about today is our efforts in deriving and investigating reduced partial differential equations for rotations constrained flows. I would like to acknowledge my collaborators who are working on this ongoing effort. So to give a quick outline of talk, I'd like to basically talk about two motivations that's really led us down this path into trying to seek reduced equations for non-hydrostatic flows, the meaning being the Ray-Benard problem and a long-range goal of looking at open ocean deep convection. I'll then formulate the problem, the equations that we work off. And it turns out, in deriving these reduced PDEs, it turns out understanding the interplay between geostrophy and the Taylor-Prandtl constraint is quite is crucial. It allows us to find a path of to classify the different types of reduced equations that arrive in the rapidly rotating limit, and also provides a pathway to understand how one can introduce non-hydrostatic flows into that framework. Given this, basically, it's kind of a straightforward exercise to sort of proceed down the asymptotic path to derive these types of quasi-geostrophic equations. And I'll do that in this section here, where I'll talk about reduced equations with a particular focus on the one that includes non-hydrostatic motions. And then I'll focus on some of our numerical investigations of this new class of equations that includes non-hydrostatic flows. I should say that much of what I talk about today can be found in these two papers, recent papers in the Journal of Fluid Mechanics. So just here's one of our primary motivation over the last few years is really looking at Rayleigh-Benard convection in the rotation constraint limit, rotation constraint being measured by this parameter, the convective Rossby number, which I've defined down here. It's defined in terms of these external parameters here, the Rayleigh number, Prandtl number, and Taylor number, and in this combination basically it gives the ratio of the characteristic rotation time of the box versus the free fall time for buoyant partial fluid to descend across the layer. Now, what I show here on the left is some experiments, beautiful pictures of experiments done by Sakai of Rayleigh-Benard convection. I guess it's this thing is going to be over my labels here. It's an experiment performed at Rayleigh number 10 to the 7. The convective Rossby number, as defined by these parameters here, is 0.1, and it's water, and it's Prandtl number. So what one can see here for this particular regime and this particular Rayleigh number, if you look at the side shot here, so we're heating from below, cooling from above, what one sees here is essentially these intense vortical structures that are spanning the layer. So you can see here a cold anomaly, which is spanning the length of the layer. And in the blue, we see the warm anomalies, which are spanning upwards in the layer. Here, if you take a snapshot at the top or slice through the top, one can see that this is just basically an ensemble of cyclonic thermal anomalies and anticyclonic thermal anomalies. These are very persistent throughout the flow and throughout the experiment, basically. And if one, Sakai has a movie on the web, basically, where if one looks at the evolution of these, basically, these are things that are just undergoing vortex-vortex interaction. There's testing implications for the mixing of the flow. So here's a schematic of, Sakai was really interested in counting the number of vortices as a function in the space of the Rayleigh number and Taylor number space, but in his theory, he came up with this schematic for the cold and these cold and hot anomalies, basically. So we concentrate here on the hot anomalies, basically. He showed basically standard picture in conservation of angular momentum. One has this accelerating fluid basically being spun up cyclonically, and as it decelerates, basically it's spun down anticyclonically, and you've got this sort of vigorous overturning motion incorporated in this. But what Sakai in his theory alludes to that there being a geostrophic balance with the horizontal motions, basically. So that if one follows quasi geostrophic theory, one's going to think of this as being horizontally non-divergent, but yet we have quite vigorous upward motions in this schematic here. And what I'll try to convince you of today that we have a theory which kind of supports this schematic basically. And the opposite holds true. The opposite holds true for the cold anomalies. So the challenge, I should say here, I kind of missed this here on this transparency. I mean, the experimental challenge really is providing quantitative measurements of the velocity and the vorticity in these flows, basically, and one would like to sort of typically move to numerical approaches to try and get some more details about what's going on in such a flow. But there are numerical challenges. One is trying to simulate the Redi-Bernard problem from the direct numerical simulation perspective. And one is that you've got to resolve all scales. The first one you encounter, basically, in this thing, there are thin, viscous, or Ekman boundary layers, basically at the top and the bottom of this flow, this box, that has to be resolved, basically, and it scales with the Taylor number to the minus one quarter, basically. So if we're talking about Taylor numbers of 10 to the 8 through 10 to the 12 in these experiments, basically, this is a pretty strong restriction for direct numerical simulations. And also, one finds with direct numerical simulations for sort of an efficient code, one advances the Coriolis force in an explicit time stepping scheme, and that will place a pretty strong restriction on if one has to resolve the inertial waves in the problem here. So this is also a temporal restriction in trying to perform direct numerical simulation. So what I show here is basically a rendition of sort of DNS work done by myself, Jim McWilliams, Sonia Legge, and Joe Wern a number of years ago, basically trying to look at Redi-Bernard convection in this rotationally constrained regime. There, the challenge here, getting down to really low convective Rossby numbers is quite a challenge due to these constraints here. And we were down about 0.75, Redi number 10 to the 7, Prandtl number 1, not water here. And what we, in fact, see, we don't see what Sakai sees in his experiments, basically. So the visualization here, the blue and the yellow is basically visualizing the top thermal boundary layer, and the red is at the lower boundary layer, and everything else in between has been rendered transparent. And what we see, basically, is that the thermal boundary layer breaks up into descended cyclonic vortices, basically. There's no evidence of this anticyclonic structures penetrating through. There's no evidence of structures penetrating through the whole layer. And in experiments by Ecke, he kind of goes through a nice cross section to try to see when these anticyclonic vortices emerge. And he points out basically it's round about this transition occurs round about Rossby number about 0.2. Okay, so doing a DNS simulation because of this rate is quite challenging. We can't get down there basically. So the challenge is basically how do we, if you want to look at this and try to understand this flow, how do we, how does one perform a numerical investigation in this regime, basically with these penalties? And what this had really led us to is trying to find sort of reduced models that can actually at least get us into this regime or the regime here, which is still, it seems, gone away, but Rossby number, convective Rossby number, much less than one. Okay, so.
There's a button you can press.
My favorite press.
Okay, well, I'll just go over it. So, let me show. I mean, this, what I have here is a movie of, it's a visualization of this flow. This was taken from a movie, it's pretty template, almost 10 years old, basically. It was rendered on VHS, but what I'd like to convince you here is that there's no structures penetrating through the layer. This is Rayleigh number 10 to the 7, Taylor number 10 to the 8, and this Rossby number about 0.75. All we see is pretty much cyclonic motions in the thermal boundary layer. So the green up here is basically visualizing the thermal anomaly.
Wait, so you see no towers connecting?
No towers connecting the bottom at this Rossby number. So let's go ahead and play this. Let's see how it goes. So what you'll see is that basically the cyclonic sense of the thermal boundary layers, the cyclonic motions, vortex dynamics, light sine vortices emerging. But if you hard to convince you, but if you look down, you don't see these things being drawn all the way through, top to bottom, basically. So we haven't cross this transition. We haven't crossed this transitional boundary.
Sorry, which direction is which axis here?
So Z is coming out here, you're in the rotating frame, so you're looking at the top of the box here, and you're looking down into one of the box, and the box is rotating the way the upper vortices are rotating, so in a cyclonic fashion.
Can we get a little bit regime just with some
Of
the large eddy simulation strategies?
Well, you have to figure out what to do with the unresolved motions. I don't know of any large eddy simulation that show this with two sine vortices. You can do it. You can pose a DNS simulation that gets you in there. One, you can look at stress-free boundaries in the way gravity and rotation are aligned, so that gets rid of the necessity to resolve the boundary layer, basically in a DNS simulation. And two, you can relax this restriction of trying to time step the Coriolis force explicitly to make an implicit time step. So that's something we're investigating.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What type of numerical scheme do you use here?
Pardon? Okay, so the questions. The numerical scheme is a spectral numerical scheme, basically. So the box is periodic in the horizontal, basically, and we're using basically Fourier modes there. And in the vertical, we're using a Chebyshev decomposition, so that kind of quadratically stacks points at the top and the bottom, such that we can resolve the thermal boundary layer. If you're looking for heat transport, studying things like heat transport, like we were then, that's important to resolve the thermal boundary layer. And the time arching scheme is actually a third order. Semi-implicit Runge-Cutter scheme that was introduced by Spillard, Moses, and Rogers about 10 in 1991 or so.
Also CFL.
Pardon? CFL. So with this time marching Earth scheme, this is like a three-step Runge-Cutter scheme. The CFL was around about 0.68, I believe, on the time set. There's another. This is a typically a long-range sort of goal, which we're trying. It's a multi-scale problem. Andy might have mentioned yesterday that this is sort of the analog problem in the ocean, that open ocean deep convection, basically. And I've kind of just grabbed this snapshot from John Marshall's review on open ocean deep convection. It kind of explores the phases of this vigorous event, basically. So on one hand, a precondition event occurring on these scales, basically, where you have a cyclonic gyro basically leads to doming of the isopycnals and weakening of the stratification within the gyro, basically. And then one has a strong cooling event, basically, which generates these vigorous downward plumes, basically, which are speculated to be rotationally constrained. The patch becomes well mixed, eventually breaks up baroclinically, basically, and then sheds these baroclinic eddies and recaps and restratifies, and then one has fresh water pushed down to the bottom, which can be circulated in things like the hairline circulation, basically. This is a multi-scale problem, and what the plume range, what our reduced equations are really focused on is this one this 1 kilometer scale. We haven't done this yet, but the really benign problem is a step in this direction. How one incorporates these sort of large-scale modulations. We have theory for that too, but I won't discuss that too much in this talk. And the Rossby number of note here is the natural Rossby number as measured by the Rossby deformation radius in the horizontal versus the vertical height, and it's defined in this way, where this is the buoyancy flux and rotation rate and the height, basically. And for the ocean, it's kind of pulling out from Marshall's review, speculating between these numbers 0.1 to 0.4. So it's believed that these plumes are rotationally influenced in their evolution. So, well, right here is just the hierarchy. What we're trying to do is trying to relax this numerical constraint. This sort of there's a long history of doing this, basically, with the Navier-Stokes equation, of course. If you just treat an incompressibility, you're filtering out sound waves, so that relaxes the restriction to following pressure waves, basically. So that's a gain computationally. Several other simplifications as you go down for a lot of flows which are hydrostatic and thin. One looks at the primitive equations, And in the case where you have rapid rotation strong stratification, this is where you get the traditional quasi-geostrophic approximation for thin layers, basically. So you have high, and the properties of that classical QG is that the motions are hydrostatic, so vertical pressure gradients are being balanced by gravity. You have geostrophy, where the horizontal pressure gradients are being balanced by the Coriolis force, and this is a diagnostic for the relation for the velocity. And one proceeds up in the asymptotic order, and one can produce the quasi-geostrophic equation, which gives you a prognostic equation for the evolution. So that's a sort of menu that we would like to sort of continue try to do for these non-hydrostatic flows. So let me formulate the equations and the model that we're going to look at and investigate and trying to sort of extract these reduced models. So we're going to consider here, we're going to imagine we're in sort of the fluid sphere, and we're going to pull out the plane parallel layer in this fashion, basically. We're sort of thinking on the F-plane, and where, if necessary, we'll include the beta effect. But so here's a geometry here with these scales denoting the zonal, the meridional, and the vertical scales here. Rotation got an F-plane is not aligned with gravity, and these are the components of the rotation vector. So this is the geometry that we are envisioning that we're working in here. And the equations here, we're going to take the Boussinesq equations, which are non-dimensionalized in the same fashion, taken from Andy's 98 paper with Pedro Embid here. So we have the momentum equation, the buoyancy equation here, and the continuity equation. And here are the important one-dimensional parameters in the sense that we have the Rossby number defining the degree of the rotational constraint. We have a Froude number here, which basically tells us the strength of the ambient stratification here. This is just something which we can impose. And a buoyancy number telling us the strength of the buoyancy force in the momentum equation, and some other things, the Euler number, strength of the pressure gradient, and we know what the Reynolds and Peclin number are. So this is the equation that we're going to play with. So, as I said, it's an instructive thing sort of trying to derive these reduced models to look at the interplay between geostrophy and the Taylor-Crowther constraint. Many are familiar with this, but I'll go through it anyway. So in this setting, so the geostrophy, if we have in the limit of low Rossby number, basically, so we have a strong Coriolis force, which is being balanced by the pressure gradient here, and we have continuity here. So Taylor, simple calculus on this balance, leading order balance, take the dot or the curl of this leading order balance gives you the Taylor-Crowther constraint. So essentially what it's telling you is that motions are going to be invariant along the rotation axis here. So either hat is basically in the direction of the rotation vector. So one can write this, so this is a diagnostic relation, and one can actually write a solution. Here I'm going to do it in somewhat non-conventional form. I'm going to do it in non-orthogonal coordinates. So we're going to take X and Y, zonal, meridional, and now rather than support going with the vertical, we're going to use the rotation axis as our coordinate system. So it's a non-orthogonal coordinate system here. And one can write out a simple solution for this, basically, which sort of satisfies these equations based on the geostrophic stream function. And again, this is where the pressure is, the geostrophic stream function in this case. And here's where one would have a non-hydrostatic component should it survive, okay, depending on what scale is being chosen here. So this, well, Taylor-Crowther, this is basically a two-dimensional solution, or an invariant. We have no variation in the direction of either, so it's a two-dimensional solution. So there's a problem here if we're trying to look at three-dimensional phenomena. Basically, if we have impenetrable boundary conditions, which we do in the Boussinesq problem, basically it's going to propagate, well, it tells you that this ageostrophic component is not enslaved in this corner system to the geostrophic component. So if you see a simple thing here, it's just if you look at the upright case, this thing's going to be identically equal zero. It's just going to propagate this thing to zero velocity throughout, which is the signature of hydrostatic flow. Basically, you've got weak vertical motions, basically. And in this formalism, basically, it ties two. So in order to get 3D phenomena, one has to find ways of relaxing the Taylor-Crowther constraint. So we discuss this right now. So here's what I sort of his standard way, which leads to the classical quasi-geostrophic equation, one basically includes in the leading order the balance, the buoyancy force, basically. And if one, if you just go through the same vector calculus on this, you find out that the Taylor Pradman constraint is indeed relaxed with the presence of this at leading order. One introduces the buoyancy this way, which gives us a thermal wind solution. And the pressure gradient along this rotation axis basically is balanced by buoyancy. If this was vertical, this is the standard hydrostatic balance. Basically, if it's off, if where the rotation is not vertical compared to gravity, one gets the quasi hydrostatic balance. This is just this being written in this is what it turns out in this non-orthogonal coordinate system. But yet we still retain the same solution to this diagnostic relation. Basically, we have a geostrophic stream function, which is the pressure. We now have, there's the ageostrophic function. The thing now, relaxing the Taylor-Pradman constraint brings back three-dimensionality into the solution. But here again, the problem here again is that if one finds that if you impose impenetrable boundary conditions again, you find that this ageostrophic non-hydrostatic component is going to be slave to the geostrophic component. Put it vertical again, it's going to tell you this is going to be weak, a weak field in this case. So although we've relaxed the Taylor-Pradman constraint, this leads to this is leading more balance for this classical quasi-geostrophic or quasi-hydrostatic, if you follow Andy's derivation in MIDA. And here, one finds out from this thermal wind relation also that the buoyancy field is actually also tied to the geostrophic stream function. So herein lies the reduction for the quasi-geostrophic equations. Basically, all the fields are described by one variable here. So there's a reduction from solving three pressure, buoyancy, all down to one variable. This is the leading order balance. I haven't talked about the prognostic equations here. So here's our approach at trying to include non-hydrostatic effects. Basically, it really relies on a reinterpretation of the Taylor-Pradman constraint, basically. So here again, now we're not going to include buoyancy. We're just going to, just have the classical, the standard geostrophic balance continuity, and Taylor-Pradman is going to be there, basically. But what we say here is that it depends on what scale. So we're going to say that rather than Taylor-Pradman acting on a large scale, we're going to say it's going to be an inner scale. Okay, so it's going to be an inner scale to the problem. So imposing the boundary conditions, we're going to take a larger scale, a multiple scales approach, basically, and that boundary condition can act on this larger scale, whereas the Taylor-Pradman could be compatible on this inner scale. So this is the way we're going to try and get around this problem. And what happens here is that now these things are completely independent, basically. The boundary condition does not enforce itself, okay, on this large scale. So we can have a geostrophic component and a geostrophic component, one hydrostatic component, existing without conflict and without incompatibility here. So this thing that I write here is perfectly compatible with geostrophy and the Taylor-Pradman constraint. We have to introduce spatial modulation along the rotation vector in the vertical, and that introduces a large vertical scale. So this is the way around the problem, and this is kind of perfect for what we're doing. We're looking at columns rather than thin sheets, basically. So this kind of lines up with the really Bernard problem and what we see there, columns and plumes. This is a side, really. Basically shows, well, I should go back here. If one keeps on thinking that if you keep increasing this angle towards the equator, you're going to find that this non-orthogonal coordinate system is going to become degenerate. Well, theory kind of handles that in the same way. You just choose, rather than choosing x, y, and z, x, y, and eta, you can choose x, z, and eta in the same way. And you can, actually, I'm not going to say much about this there. One can sort of go to the equator and derive a class of equatorial quasi-geostrophic equations, probably not appropriate for terrestrial applications, but maybe applicable to things like Jupiter, banana cells, things you see in that regime. So I won't say too much about that today. So the two descriptions I've given you, basically, one of resolving geostrophy and the Taylor Proudman constraint. One was introducing buoyancy, and that really lends itself to the classical quasi-geostrophic approximation, which is thin, which is a thin layer. And the other one goes to the other extreme. Basically, we're talking about sort of plumes or columnar motions, basically. So really, this is kind of highlights that one should be looking at, you know, the role, what role does spatial anisotropy play in deriving these reduced equations. So that's what I'll have to go on here. So this is just a review again of what we just found, basically. So in the thin aspect ratio limit, basically, we find that, well, impenetrability is kills three-dimensional phenomena. So basically, what one must relax the Taylor Proudman constraint, introduce the buoyancy, and that allows us to reincorporate the three-dimensional aspects, and is perfectly compatible in the large aspect ratio limit, which I'm calling plumes and columns here. Both of these, by the way, alleviate what I talked about here. They both filter Ekman layers, basically. So. And we'll see that. I'll see that as we derive the models, basically. So in the vertical, Ekman layer essentially become passive. There's no need to resolve. There's really no need to resolve. Okay. So this is. So I'm going to spend some slides, a few slides on this. So this is a summary of our classification and our reduced models in this diagram in the plane here. So along. The vertical axis on this side, basically, we're just varying the aspect ratio from pancakes to columns. And if you recall, we've got our plane parallel box, which we're varying as a function of latitude or collatitude here. This kind of shows, as we vary the collatitude, the classes of equations that we've identified in this regime. So I'm going to spend some slides just talking about this lower half here. So where aspect ratio is 1 for cubes, L going down to pancakes here. So essentially, the way one derives this theory, or the way we understand the thing, we're just going to restretch the equations, basically, here. So here's this will be the classical QG. So I put this up just to show, you know, not to read, but just to show we're going to restretch the equations according to this stretching, basically in AZ and AY. Typically, we're going to focus on AZ. AY will be an equatorial region, but I'm just thinking about that as one now. I'm not going to talk too much about that. I'm not going to talk about this in this talk. Rossby number small, and with AZ being small, order one, basically highlights the magnitudes of these terms, basically. We can look at geostrophy and pick out leading order balances, and then move on to try and derive the outcomes of the quasi-geostrophic equation. So I have them down here on the right. So classically, in the case where we're looking down here, where AZ is much less than 1, so this is pancake-type motions, you break the equations I just put up and separate it out into component form and it's rescaled in this way. Just turns out that we get the standard thing we know about quasi-geostrophy here, that the horizontal momentum equations is just balanced. Coriolis is balancing the pressure gradient force. This naturally gives us that the motions are horizontally non-divergent and it's hydrostatic. So hydrostatic is falling out of as a consequence of this. And this is what I've just said before. Everything can be reduced to thinking about one component here. As you go up to moving up in this, I'm going to forget about this row here. I'm just really thinking about ectotropics and polar latitudes here. In the quasi-hydrostatic formulation here, this is one which Pedro Embid and Maida. It's the same, pretty much the same thing. In what one sees in the leading order balance is a quasi-hydrostatic balance here. So you've got pressure, you've got the buoyancy force here, and now the horizontal component of the rotation vector now comes into play. But one still has a geostrophic balance in the horizontal. Basically, in the same conclusions can be drawn here, that you have horizontal non-divergent motions and everything can be described by one stream function. The only difference here is that the buoyancy now has the full rotation vector incorporated in it, basically, and I won't talk about that. So once you have this, typically the thing to do is just, I mean, this is an expansion ROSB number. You're just going to go to the next order in the governing equations, basically. So here's our solution related to just geostrophic stream function, pose an expansion in ROSB number. We've got the leading order dynamics. Basically, we try to proceed to the next order. And what one finds is that, you know, this is the closed set you get, basically. So this is basically taking the horizontal momentum equation, taking the curl of this thing. So this is the vorticity, basically. We find now we include a stretching term with a weak upward vertical velocity here. And so we need a closure here. So this is where we go to the buoyancy equation for help, basically. If we have the right stratification, basically, we can get coupling between the weak upward vertical velocity and the ambient stratification. And this is sort of standard. You can find this in Pedosky and Salmon's book, basically. One eliminates the vertical velocity for the quasi-geostrophic equation. So these are Andy calls these slanted quasi-Hodges.
Oh, the slanted QG, I think.
Slanted QG. You know, we adopted tilted quasi-Hodges stack just to fit into our
terminology.
Yeah, so this is basically, this term in here is the potential vorticity. These are dissipation terms, so the standard thing turns up here. If you get dissipation, you're basically disinvecting the potential vorticity, which turns out to be the crucial dynamic variable here. And if you look at these equations one finds out that, you know, the savings here is that you're filtering inertial gravity, waves here. So this is the one where aspect ratio was 1, but going to the upright case, basically you recover the functional form for the classical QG equations, basically of Charlie, and I've written that, it's also in Pedlowski's book. So let's go on to second. So that's just sort of grounding, basically how you know, quasi-geostrophic theory is actually working, basically. So here's, you know, let's go on to the case where a large aspect ratio flow. So there we saw that with the Taylor-Pradman constraint and geostrophy, basically we're doing a multiple scales expansion. Taylor-Pradman is working on a small vertical scale here, and then we've got vertical modulation. So what one has to do to the governing equations, we're going to introduce this multiple scales expansion in the vertical here. It sort of turns out that one also needs to sort of include a multiple scales in time to get the theory to hang together. And then you break the you break your fields up into this under this Reynolds decomposition into a mean component. So that's a component where we average over the small scales, basically, and one gets looks for flow, which is varies on the modulation scale on the slow time scale, and this is the fluctuating component as defined by this average here. So an example would be, well, if one goes to the mean, if you separate the equation down into mean and fluctuating parts, one can do some characters that actually simplifies the analysis. Basically, of course, there's going to be no upward mass flux. Basically, we get from the continuity equation, we find that the mean momentum, so that's averaging out the horizontal, is still in hydrostatic balance, and we get no large scale flows. And here is that, you know, here's an example of a continuity equation. It breaks out in this way. So AZ is large. So one's going to see here, you're going to get this horizontally or non-divergent motions at leading order. And at higher orders, you're going to bring in the vertical velocity. But it's not going to force it to be small, because this is small here, basically. So we can have order one vertical velocities in this situation. So that's up here, basically. So here again, this is just showing you that we separate this down. This is just the fluctuating component. Basically, you're putting in these numbers being large, basically, and you're just following the perturbation theory in the flow. Okay, so just like we did before, here's sort of the leading order balances you find. So I've described here sort of the quasi-geostrophic theory that occurs here. As you increase AZ, okay, what you actually find is that formally you can actually extend the regime of validity for these equations. So in the polar case, QG can be extended to, you know, column of motion, so long as it's not too large. basically. And the same with the quasi-hydrostatic equation. You can extend them so long as it's not too large, basically. It's basically when you get to aspect ratios of this order, basically, where one massive fluid, one hydrostatic, non-hydrostatic comes into play. So, and in this case, this is what we've said here. Basically, you get on the small scale, so TWIDL means looking at things on the small scales that are separated from large scales. X could be Z or Y here. We're just taking this to be Z. You get geostrophic balance, basically, and incompressibility on the small scales. Here's our leading order solution again. So pressure is the geostrophic stream function in here. This is independent. This now is a totally independent field, and we have to find what this does, basically, which is what the search is about, basically. On the large scales, we get a hydrostatic balance and no large scale flows. So standard thing here, just doing perturbation theory. So here's our leading order, which we just found the solution to. As you proceed to the next order, basically in the asymptotics of the perturbation theory, you're going to get, you know, so here's the leading order, here's the same linear operator as we see at the leading order. We're going to get stuff here on the right-hand side, basically. And what you have to ensure is that the stuff in the right-hand side doesn't project onto the null space. So this is a solvability equation, and this is how we're going to derive the non-hydrostatic QG equations here. So just presume that's done. I'm just going to present for you now the equations that we get, okay, and then we'll talk about going to sort of looking at simulations of these equations. So what we find through that solvability equation, so I'm just going to, which comes out of the momentum equation, we get an evolution equation for the vertical vorticity, okay, as defined by the geostrophic stream function here. And the this is what is different from QG. We also get an evolution equation for the vertical velocity, okay, or the ageostrophic component. It's not a diagnostic here. It's a fully dynamic component of the equation set. J is a Jacobian operator, basically, and this is just the horizontal advection of a quantity here. So here it'd be the horizontal advection of vertical vorticity, horizontal advection of vertical velocity, which is a signature of the geostrophy and the flow, basically, with vertical advection terms due to this large aspect ratio has been rendered subdominant.
T is the short time scale. Is that the little t? Everything evolves on that.
Yeah, so T is the it's a short time scale rotation time scale. So
can
we
rescale the Rossby number now?
No, the Rossby number was an expansion parameter. Okay? So it's just yeah, so we pose an expansion in a Rossby number, so it's just scaling out. So all these the equations are Rossby number free, basically. That's what we're using to separate orders. So the Rossby number is just like, it's like an epsilon, we're just going down in an expansion, it's not there. Okay, so this is the...
After you've done all this, you're
left. Yeah, so I should have, to answer your question, these should have zeros on them, okay? If you want to put a zero subscripts, meaning that they're the leading order, fields in the asymptotic expansion.
And gamma, what's gamma again?
I've left this in. Gamma is the strength of the buoyancy forces. And this combination shows you, if you want to bring it in, basically gamma has to be order, I think that should be, yeah, order 1 over the Rossby number. Gamma should be 1 over the Rossby number. That's the type. Okay? So it tells you, I leave these things in as I go through, so you can actually see, basically infer what the scalings of these parameters are here. And we make no scaling assumptions on the Reynolds.
So right now we don't see Matlin-E cyclone, anti-cyclone, asymmetries anymore.
No. Well, yes.
They're disappeared. They disappeared in this level.
Is it still QG-ish?
It's still QG-ish, yes.
You still have a matching issue if you really care about your Rayleigh-Baynard problem at the boundary layer.
Oh, the boundary, so let me get...
Will you discuss that later?
You're still in the interior.
Right now you're in the interior. You'll get to that.
We'll get to that. Okay, so, well, let's just go through the terms here. So this is, you know, tendencies for vertical vorticity, vertical velocity. I've explained this term. So let's look at the only place that the large-scale modulation turns up is basically under these stretching terms here. So, and this is what's coupling the geostrophic component, okay, to the ageostrophic or non-hydrostatic component in Z here. So And you can induce some standard things, which you saw from the Sakai's cartoon picture. Take this to the other side. You can see the vertical acceleration is going to spin up vorticity. Deceleration is going to spin it down. So this cartoon picture that Sakai had is sort of built in under this picture here. This term is basically on the other side. It's a geostropic stream function. It's a pressure gradient. So whereas this was typically balanced under hydrostatic balance here, we see that the pressure gradient is unbalanced and it can drive vertical motions. Okay, and here if you actually analyze this, yes, we still have inertial waves basically, but the rescaling has showed basically we have suppressed those waves that are on scales less than L, which is our plume scale. Okay, so that's a saving in that sense. We're not going to be following those around if we're going to do an explicit time stepping like we do in the DNS. Okay, so we get to Andy's question. Now, if you look at the dissipation terms, basically, what you find, just because we're looking at these stretch motions here and the Taylor-Proudman is in effect, this is the upright case, I've kind of simplified things here, that these only include horizontal derivatives. Okay, there's no vertical derivatives here, and this is the way that vertical diffusion is negligible, basically, and this is the way we kind of do an end round of having to resolve the Ekman boundary layers, basically. So they're not there, only horizontal diffusion is playing a part here. So, as I say here, the Ekman layers are in fact filtered in this case. We don't have to resolve them. And we actually show this. We actually go through, in this paper here, we actually go through an analysis of the layer, and we show that it's passive, it's slave to the interior flow, not the other way around, basically. So that's a constraint we have here. We don't have to, in the DNS, you still have to sort of follow them around to do the computations right here. In this prescription, we don't have to do that. So, and then, if really Bernard, we're going to put in buoyancy here. So excuse me, that should be a Rossby number again. This is not the correct thing. So we're going to couple it to the buoyancy. So you go to the buoyancy equation, and this is the leading order buoyancy equation. Similar terms here. Horizontal advection of the buoyancy, only horizontal dissipation of the buoyancy, and it's coupled both to the ambient stratification, which one can impose at the beginning, given the right strength of stratification here, and also we're doing this Reynolds decomposition. Basically, there's also a mean buoyancy term that we also need to deduce. Okay, so we have to go back to the mean equations and look what the leading order look for what. Look for an equation for the mean buoyancy. So I've put it in here, basically, and what we see is the same thing when you average the temperature equation. Basically, this is a slow time scale that comes in at this, that can come in at this time. This is just the vertical advection of the convective, it's the convective flux, the vertical gradient of the vertical flux, and dissipation comes in at this time. So this is where the nonlinearity between these equations is being invoked. And again, one of the things, as I said before, this thing is hydrostatic pressure balance, basically. The dynamic pressure due to vertical velocity is small here. Okay, so this doesn't mean that the layer is stable, just means that this is how the mean layer adjusts, basically. For the ocean problem, if one introduces multiple scales in the horizontal, then you can actually start coupling this thing to large scale flows. But we're not going to do this here. So, and if you look at these equations, they do obviously want them to do some nice things. They conserve, if you neglect dissipation, they have conservation laws. They conserve energy to this order, they conserve potential vorticity. So they're doing, they're not violating any significant conservation. So now I'm going to sort of move over to the Reddy Bernard problem. The scaling I chose was kind of generic. Basically, Reddy Bernard, we like to talk about Rayleigh numbers, Taylor numbers, and Prandtl numbers. So the appropriate time scale is to choose your velocity time scale with the based on the diffusion. Okay, on this length scale here. And if you go through that, you find, if you go through the Rossby number scales with the Taylor number, the rotation number to the -1/6, then the thing Reynolds number becomes 1 in the equation. That's how we do, just putting those parameters in, doesn't mean Reynolds number is 1. Pecker number becomes a Prandtl number, and this buoyancy number actually becomes this combination here, basically. And I left the Rossby number in here, so it's going to tell you how the Rayleigh number scales. Basically, if you want to make this an order one quantity, it shows that the scale Rayleigh number scales with the Taylor number to the minus the Rayleigh number scale. This Rayleigh number, which is the actual Rayleigh number, scales with the Taylor number to the 2/3. So many of you know, if you look at Chandrasekhar's book, what we've just done here is we covered the classical linear stability theory in rapidly rotating limit, the Higg for Rayleigh-Bernard convention. And in that case, Rayleigh-Bernard, you can pull it out from Chandrasekhar, basically, this turns out to be the critical scale Rayleigh number, that Rayleigh number. So I'll probably want to go to lunch, I probably won't spend too much time here. Numerics, whatever question we're doing, spectral again, Chebyshev, Fourier, okay, same time stepping scheme, mixed, implicit, explicit, Runge-Kutta scheme by Spillard, Moses, and Rogers, basically. We solved the parallel code solved, you know, on these machines. And the suite for the Rayleigh-Bernard problem ranges from this resolution to this resolution. The solutions evolve on this fast time scale. Basically, the mean temperature gradient evolves on the slow time scale. So that means that we really should be doing an average, basically. But we'll show that basically, if you have a large enough box, basically, we get good averaging based from the having many plumes in the box, basically, that we don't really have to enforce. We don't really have to enforce this. So again, here's a schematic, basically, Rayleigh-Bernard. This is pulled out of, you know, straight out of Chandrasekhar, Taylor number, Rayleigh number. Our theory, in validation of our theory, captures this asymptotic line here, no motion, convection. In this case, it's a rapidly our theory is rapidly rotating, so basically if you work it out, I mean, it says that the convective Rossby number should be small, so kind of, this is a schematic. This line is 0.2, based on Ecke's experiment, basically, so our equations are valid in this regime. Our equation will be valid in this regime. So if we keep increasing the Rayleigh number, eventually you're going to trip this thing and you're going to get into something which is not rotationally constrained. So the way to do it is just keep pushing the Taylor number up here and get this thing is expanding so you can get to larger and larger Rayleigh number. And this is the two experiments that were like Rubioff and Ecke took a sweep across here, and this is how they found the transition point from flows which are dominated by only cyclonic vortices to ones which are anticyclonic and cyclonic. And these are Sakai's experiments here. His visualization was basically this point here. So, jumping ahead here, we ran some simulations. This is just a profile of the heat transport. I don't want to say too much about heat transport. I just want to show you that this kind of captures the time evolution of these PDEs. There's a rapid starting from basically the base state, basically which is a linear temperature profile, a little bit of noise, basically let it go, it rapidly contracts onto into a statistically steady state. This is parameter number 1, 7, and infinity here. So basically, and this is the number of thermal diffusion timescales that we're running here. So this is the horizontal timescale here. And if you actually calculate how many rotation timescales, this is sort of the scaling you get here. This thing is going many, 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 many rotation times, basically. So, I know, Jim, you remember back when we were doing these simulations, we were doing one or two rotations of the box before these things were getting computationally expensive. In this case, we're able to go many, many rotation times. So let me talk about some of what we, sort of the flow regimes we see as we go, you know, anyway, this is a scaling regime. As we increase the Rayleigh number, basically, what do we see in the case of Rayleigh-Bernard convection? So, and I have a few movies that I'll show towards the end here. So, just above, this is critical Rayleigh number, above critical 20, essentially what we see is that we're capturing the right thing. You know, we see that the equations in a statistically steady state evolve into these columnar structures. So this is a temperature anomaly from the side. We're seeing these cold and hot anomalies, basically, spanning the layer of the flow. These are just snapshots from the top. So the columnar structure is clear, basically. If I showed you the vorticity field and have a rendition for this, you see the same thing. For a hot vortice, which is in red, fluid is being accelerated, it's spinning cyclonically, and spinning and going up, being decelerated, spinning anticyclonically about mid-plane. So this is, again, Sakai's picture. As we go, so we have three regimes I'm going to explain here. As we increase the Rayleigh number, we trip a regime, basically, where we get out of this sort of conmer, tightly packed structures into this regime, which we call the shielded vortex regime. If you actually look at one of these, these are kind of strange structures. You look at these vortices. This is, again, the temperature anomaly. We see, like, cold or hot anomalies, basically, and this shielded by anomalies of the opposite sign. So in this case, this is a cold anomaly, and it's shielded by a jacket of hot temp, positive anomaly here. The rendition, the visualizations, because of the boundary layers, basically, they dictate sort of how we, our color scale here. This thing, you take slices through at any level, you actually see that these shields, these opposite signs, persist throughout the layer. So this is just basically a visualization. Yeah, they extend across the layer, and I'll show you a movie in a few seconds about this. But if you actually look at the heat content, you know, these things are really stable structures, and they're carrying like 60% of the heat flux across the layer, basically, and they're, you know, they persist.
So the velocity profile associated with each one of these is finite, it's bounded because of the shield.
Zero circulation.
Yes, So that's right. So if you do it, if you look at this, they all have this kind of, they all have this kind of structure, basically, and effectively zero circulation. And
Is there a compensating subsidence around these things? What's producing with those skirts and electricity or opposite side?
Good question. this is what the what's produced here. I mean, you actually look at these things and we fit them, they actually look like Hankel functions, basically. So solutions to, and we've been fitting them with that, basically. So you can think about these as particles of the flow, you can get a structure and you can bring all your machinery to bear on.
Well, these look like the nearly parallel vortex filament things Pierre-Louis-Leoncin idea.
Yeah, sure. So eventually you push it again, basically, and then these columns basically become destabilized, basically, and what you get is the geostrophic turbulence. I have a movie which shows this. So essentially what you see is there's no connection between top and bottom again, and basically all the dynamics are happening in the top and bottom thermal boundary layers. So what you see in both boundary layers, you see both cyclonic and anticyclonic anomalies in these things being generated at the boundary layers.
So what's the difference? You increase the Rayleigh number?
Just increasing the Rayleigh number, the scale Rayleigh number. So we're just pumping the Rayleigh number up. And
is this pretty slick?
It's impenetrable. It turns out that it doesn't really, mechanical boundary layers don't matter, just really, because they're subdominant, basically. So the only thing you need to impose on these equations is the fact that this thing is impenetrable. If you go back, the dissipation terms only at horizontal dissipation. So the equation is actually second order in vertical, so only need to impose.
So vertical boundaries are free slip. Or no.
Impenetrable. So here's that work. If you gave me a free slip boundary condition, I can go and do the Ekman layer analysis and then I can tell you how that boundary layer will respond to the interior. Okay, so that's all.
What does the vertical profile of temperature look like in this region?
Okay, so
the mean profile.
Can we hold on to that? That'll be sort of one of the final comments. Okay, so
cyclones dominating?
They're both in this thing, so if you look at here, it's both cyclones and anticyclones here.
But if you look at skew, is it zero or is it slightly positive?
We see simulations where it kind of flutters around zero, basically. So
the conditional skewnesses on Z look different in this problem. I think that's what Mike is talking about, from top to bottom.
Aren't your equations parity symmetric?
The parity symmetric, yeah.
So but it looks like we have more hot and cold on top and more cold and hot on the bottom. So
yeah, that's
a conditional skewness that
looks like the boundary maybe
symmetry
breaking that, but I don't know.
That's the point.
If you went back, if you observe when I was in the shield economy regime, all it seems to care about is about these columns transporting heat. It didn't really care about how many cold ones or how many warm ones you had, basically. It just seems to care about how you transport heat. So you see a strong asymmetry.
You should do this. Given a statistic, it's easy to do.
Yeah.
Be parity or variance.
Yes. So here's a movie. Just shows this. This is showing the movie of the shield, the shielded column regime. So this is the one, Rayleigh number 40, and this is where we see these halos, basically zero circulation. So you can deduce when I play the movie what happens in this case. So they have zero circulation. It spins up. We start off from a square pattern, but it doesn't matter when you start. You reach this statistically steady state round about. This time here is when you're going to start seeing some of these shields forming, basically. At this stage, you're pretty much seeing all the vortices that are going to be columns that are going to be in here, basically. And what you really see is that the plumes evolve as weakly interacting particles. Never merge, basically, because of this weak circulation. If you kind of look at these things, they'll get close together. But you know, they know about that, they know they're there, but they never, there's no strong interaction. So you can see things here, you know, it's just, they're just evolving, you know, really slow dynamics. This is, they persist throughout the whole flow. So one of the things we're going to do, evolving these things, you know, it's basically, if you treat these things as a particle, we get a good analytic description of this, we can reduce the PDEs into particle dynamics, basically, and have a means to describe this flow. So
shields seem to evolve on a slow time scale.
Yeah. So it's quite strange. I mean, this seems like it's involved in the Hamiltonian dynamics, but we've got dissipation in there. It's kind of used, it seems like that's being used up in the internal structure of these modes here.
They're in the cores.
Yeah, they're in the cores, yeah. And then everything else is evolving on a sort of an implicit fashion. But so this is a, so and these things are like, you know, you have the hetons basically, but these are really doing what the pictures of the helions are doing. Basically, you've got cyclonic,
absolutely, yeah.
Anti-cyclonic carrier, and it's carrying flux. It's carrying flux up.
Do you like hetons with skirts?
Careful, mate.
I'm not going to go touch that one. So I'll move on. So okay. So this is a parameter number one, but once you go to the final regime of geostrophic turbulence, basically these columns break down. It's just basically going to be a turbulent mess. But once again, you're going to see cyclonic and anticyclonic vortices in both boundary layers here. So this is different color scheme rendering the top and the box here. So I'll just let this one go, and just descends into this turbulent mess. So again, this thing is geostrophic balance. If you look at the horizontal flow, just the equation, you know, they're being balanced geostrophically, significant vertical motions basically, and this is the sort of thing you're seeing in the flow here. And this is again pattern number one of this grid resolution. So So Jim, here's what you're asking, basically. What happens to the thermal structure, basically? So for all these parameter numbers, what we see is that we start off with from the linear stable profile. What you expect, if things like traditional non-rotating Rayleigh-Raynaud convection, you should get to a well-mixed interior, but that's not what we're seeing here. Basically, what you're seeing is that the temperature gradient starts evolving towards this, but eventually saturates. Okay, it saturates at, you know, this is at reduced Rayleigh number 160. Saturation is actually more gray for the lower Prandtl number and weaker for the largest Prandtl number. So we do a Prandtl number infinity scaling. And what we see, this is basically goes back to what we found in 1996. Basically, at least in the turbulent regime, these plumes basically have significant horizontal mixing. So if they're trying to carry the heat anomaly from one surface to the other, basically, and they're just getting wiped out, dumping their heat at that level, raising the temperature, basically, and you can build these temperature gradients this way. And it happens for all Prandtl numbers. The purpose of putting the Prandtl number infinity there basically shows mixing is different in the rotating case from the non-rotating case, basically. You're not gonna build isothermal interiors. So if you've got a parameterization that is based on generating isothermal interiors for rotating convection, it's not going to do the right thing, basically, because you're building these, you're maintaining these unstable temperature gradients. Yeah. And this is just the same analysis here. Here, what we're just looking is at the temperature gradient and the midplane. It turns out we can, PDEs actually have single mode solutions. Okay, so these are basically, you specify a horizontal plan form and you can get a vertical structure equation and you can evolve those vertical structure equation. It turns out there's no mixing there. These are kind of ordered flows basically. And if you look at the mean temperature gradient, it does evolve towards the isothermal interior, and it scales like the scale Rayleigh number, the inverse scale Rayleigh number here. What we see with all the other Prandtl numbers is that they kind of track this for a while. As soon as you go from this regime, which is shielded vortex, where you get efficient heat transport, so it kind of tracks this, so this is kind of organized, to a turbulent regime, but you get this strong mixing in the horizontal, basically, and that's where you start sustaining the unstable temperature gradients in the interior.
So what causes these little skirts? What's going on? Is there it's sucking in the boundary layer. We just had a little seminar on the boundary layer, rapidly rotating vortices. So this must be boundary layer control, because you see the skirts in the boundary layer, what's going on.
There isn't really a, I don't quite understand where there isn't really a boundary layer.
No, no. So I don't think
in the
what, I mean, I think, it's hard to say. I mean, it's, I would say it's a boundary layer effect here. I mean, I think it's really an interior response to the layer, basically. So, to be honest, I don't think we quite understand why these fittings form with anti-cyclonic skirts. If you have some good ideas, basically, please please enlighten me here. So, but you know, we're in the process of trying to look at these things and trying to break it down. So I'm going to lunchtime here, so I should summarize here. So the thing we've really done, we've really explored, okay, the various, you know, through looking at spatial anisotropy, basically what are the consequences for quasi-geostrophic equations, and we've come up with a new class that is consistent. It includes a coupling between agiostrophic motion and geostrophic motion, shows simulations of the Rayleigh-Bernard problem, basically showing that we're doing it. It's capturing the sort of thing you saw in the experiments of Sakai. Here are the advantages, basically, you're not filtering the Ekman boundary layers, small scale gravity waves, so there's spatial temporal advantages, so numerical simulation. Thing we haven't done, which we should be doing, we need to do a validation of this with the Boussinesq equation. So the hard thing is simulating the Boussinesq equation, trying to get down and find out what's the range of validity and Rossby numbers for these equations. You know, that's something we'd like to be able to say here. These are standard things. I've just talked about these important findings here. And you know, we have simulations going on right now in the tilted F plane. That's quite easy to do. It's no different here. These are some of the things like what happens over the equatorial region. There may be some interesting because of
luxuriously for the equatorial basis, because you have east-west very narrow. You have a tropopause of 16 kilometers, and you'd have a tall theory going north-south, which isn't very natural for the equatorial waveguide on there. Observed phenomena.
And I alluded to this, basically, if you include a large scale in the horizontal, you can couple these things to large scale flow, so you have true multi-scale equations. We can simulate both dynamics there. And I talked about the particle model. So thank you for your time.